directly to the front, eh? You can do the final.
You have to be aggressive. If you're not aggressive, you're not in the race.
Is it a little bit uncomfortable that you've got guys that people say, we don't really like the fact that you've got this ex-doper on your team and so on and so forth? Yes, that's extremely uncomfortable.
I'm very busy, but I always find a little bit of time for our listeners, for you.
With exclusive interviews and the best analysis on two wheels, this is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Daniel Freib.
Hello.
And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Lionel. Hello, Daniel. Lionel, where the hell are we?
We're in my front room today in Hertfordshire.
We're in rural, not London.
Rural, not London. Yeah, I know Daniel. Daniel seems a bit subdued at having to leave the security. The sort of the umbilical cord of London has been snatched away from him.
I feel like that episode of Ali G when he goes into the country and he sees a sheep for the first time. It's a little bit like that. Anyway,
are you suggesting we'll take Daniel to a petting zoo later to show him some animals?
I don't know. Are you up for that, Daniel?
All right, sure.
Right, well, listen, this is going to be quite a short podcast because we've got a big week coming up with Bradley Wiggins, our record, on Sunday the 7th of June in London. We will be producing a special preview podcast, which will be available on Thursday, with interviews with Chris Boardman, Graham O'Brien, Alex Dowsett, and Bradley Wiggins himself. So that will go out on Thursday. And on Sunday, are we all ready for this, chaps? We are going to be podcasting live from the London Velodrome. Have you been practicing for that, Lionel?
Well, we're going to practice shortly, aren't we? We're messing with the space-time continuum, aren't we? So keep an eye on our Twitter handle, which is cycling_podcast, and that's the best chance you've got of keeping up with what we're doing this week.
Absolutely. Okay, so this podcast, we're going to wrap up the Giro, which was won at the weekend by Alberto Contador in pretty decisive fashion, but there was a sort of late wobble. Saturday stage to Sestriere, final mountain stage. He did at one point look as if he was in trouble. The Astana riders, Fabio Aru and Mikel Landa, who were sitting second and third overall, took off, dropped Contador, and there was a moment where it perhaps looked as though his overall lead might be in jeopardy, although he seemed to have it fairly in control, certainly on the climb up to Sestriere. And I suppose the question is, a team like Astana, finishing riders second and third on the podium, is that a success or a failure, Daniel?
Well, I mean, they were the dominant team of the Giro. Obviously, on Saturday on the stage to Sestriere, the difficulty for them was that Landa attacked probably too early in relation to Aru's attack. What they really needed to do was kind of attack in quick succession so that they could ride to the finish, well, hopefully from their point of view, together. But they were left with a bit of a dilemma when Landa was over a minute ahead of Aru, I think, and at that point Contador started to struggle, but it was really too big a gap for Landa to reasonably wait for Aru, although Aru did eventually catch him. But by that point, there wasn't a lot of room left for them to sort of work together and gain time and put Contador even more against the ropes.
I mean, the leadership of Astana seemed to swing from one to the other, and that was understandable in a sense because they seemed to have different good days and bad days, and there was a real dilemma, I think, wasn't there, for the Astana management on Saturday, deciding whether to put all their eggs in the Landa basket or the Aru basket. And in the end, it seemed that Landa was sacrificed for Aru, who won his second stage.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the most impressive thing about those 2 days. Aru won a 6-hour, 24-minute stage to Chavignier on Friday, and then 5 hours, 12 minutes in the saddle on Saturday. You know, that's over 11 and a half hours of racing, and Aru won basically the two of the toughest mountain stages back-to-back, as Landa had done earlier in the race. But, of course, Landa's two mountain stage wins came split by a rest day. So, you know, Astana kind of bossed the mountain stages, but really the gap to Contador was still too great on the final mountain stage. So whatever they were going to do, they needed Contador to collapse fairly spectacularly. Yeah, he cracked a little bit, but he didn't... You know, he didn't really look like he was in danger of losing any more than a couple of minutes or so that he did.
And it was, but 2 minutes to win overall by 2 minutes, it's not a crushing victory, is it? It was, you know, he was managing his losses on that penultimate day, but I'd been writing an article about how decisive, how impressive it had been, and I had to tone it down a little bit based on that performance. Or was it, you know, he celebrated as he came across the line. He knew what he was doing. He measured, you could say that he measured his effort perfectly, and perhaps with a view to the Tour de France, not wanting to go too deep. But in the end, the final analysis, he didn't win a stage. He's won the race by 2 minutes. It's hardly a crushing victory, is it?
No, but as we said last week, it doesn't really need to be, does it? The nature of riding Grand Tours for the victory is that you make the gains when you can and you limit your losses when you have to, and that is exactly what Contador did. And, I mean, he's won now the Vuelta and the Giro. You know, he could... The Contador slam could be on if he wins the Tour de France. And, you know, if he were to be defending champion of all three races or reigning champion of all three Grand Tours, you know, that is quite a remarkable achievement for him. Whether or not we'll look back at it and say, you know, where does it fit in the kind of annals of decisive Grand Tour victories, in a way, that doesn't really matter. He got the job done, he won it, and, you know, even though he was put under a bit of pressure on the last mountain stage, he was never in danger of losing it.
Can Contador recover for the Tour, Daniel?
If you look at his record, he has never performed well in Grand Tours as close together as the Giro and the Tour, so I think it's doubtful that he's going to be able to do the double. Whether the sort of time he lost at Sestia, whether that was weakness or whether that was him just managing his advantage, we don't really know. I mean, the one thing that we do have to stress to put in context what a dominant performance it really still was that he had ridden without a team for 3 weeks, or he'd certainly ridden the last 100 kilometres of most of the difficult stages with one or two teammates.
Well, that is an interesting one, because Tinkoff Saxo finished with a full complement of 9 riders, and, you know, Oleg Tinkoff, who's certainly not easily pleased, was singing the praises of the team and what a great job they'd done. Now, doubtless, there's a lot of things that go on in stages that we don't see, but in crucial moments, including on Saturday, Contador was left isolated with a long way still to go, and that's happened on several occasions on, you know, dangerous stages. And it certainly hasn't looked as though it was a strong team performance by what on paper looked like a strong team.
No, as Daniel says, you know, for the last 100 kilometres of the key mountain and hilly stages, Contador has looked isolated. It's going back to the pattern spotting. I think I made the point a few weeks ago when the Giro sort of exploded in those first few days. You definitely got the sense from watching TV of how much stronger and more visible Astana were than Tinkoff Saxo when the going got tough. Remember, Tinkoff Saxo did all that, in hindsight, ludicrous work in those early days when really they didn't need to be stamping that authority on the race. Although you could argue maybe they issued a bit of a statement there and made Contador feel confident in his team. When push came to shove, he wasn't really... badly isolated, really, until the Saturday stage to Sestriere. But somebody made the point that if he'd punctured, you know, he may well have had a fair wait for a wheel. He would have to wait for a team car, wherever that was or what have you. But then, you know, he had time in hand. He could have taken a wheel from a rival team and taken a 2-minute penalty and still won the Giro.
British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Coming up on British Eurosport, the Critérium du Dauphiné starts on Sunday, the 7th of June through to the 16th of June. Tour de Suisse begins on the 13th of June to the 21st of June. At the Dauphiné, we'll see Chris Froome and Vincenzo Nibali. And in Switzerland, Nairo Quintana, the Tour de France favourites, all in action there. Every stage live on the Eurosport player with highlights on British Eurosport. We mentioned earlier our special podcast coming up on Bradley Wiggins, Our Record. We should point out that they're sponsored by Jaguar. Thank you very much to Jaguar for allowing those to happen. I'm going to abuse my position on the podcast by saying a very big thank you to Air Roads CC, and in particular Alan and Arnie Thompson. They invited me up to the final ever edition of the Davy Bell Memorial Road Race, which was also the Scottish National Championship this year. And it was a fantastic event, not least because I met Ian Steele, the legendary Scottish cyclist who won the Peace Race in 1952 and also rode the Tour de France in 1955. He was also a teammate of the original Pedlar de Charme, Hugo Cobley. So you just mentioned these names or these races to him and outpoured a whole load of stories. A very sort of boyish and youthful 86-year-old Ian Steele and fantastic company. So thank you very much to everyone at Ayr Roads for that, for a great weekend.
British Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Back to the Giro, though. We're still pouring over the Giro. Lionel, you mentioned earlier that had it been 4 or 5 weeks long, then Ryder Hesjedal might have won it eventually. He might at least have won a stage eventually.
Well, yeah, he certainly enlivened the final week, a bit like he did in 2012 when he won the Giro, but this time he was too far back, perhaps by design, not sure. But certainly he was the rider who, every day in the mountains, was aggressive and shaping the race. There was a day when he and Contador were together and... you know, Contador was bridging through all those gaps, and Hesjedal, he looked really good. He clearly gets less bad.
When you say he looked really good, you mean he looked really strong?
Well, he looked really strong, yeah. I mean, he's not, it's not the most attractive riding style. I mean, it's quite exhausting to sit and watch for a long period of time, Hesjedal, all over the bike, kind of quite an ungainly style, but instantly recognisable, of course. But the thing about Hesjedal is he seems to deteriorate at a sort of slower rate than perhaps some of the other GC riders, and fair play to him. Fifth place overall is a good result in a very eclectic top 10 of nationalities. A couple of Spaniards, of course, Contador and Mikel Landa. Landa's Basque, of course. A couple of Italians, Fabio Aru and Damiano Caruso. But then there's a Costa Rican, Andre Amador, who, if it weren't for Landa, Amador would be the rider you would say was the revelation of the Giro, really.
We actually got somebody on Facebook pointed out that we should have flagged up Amador's performance last week. But yeah, fourth overall in the end, a terrific performance. Slightly a la Zubeldia, perhaps. Does he get the Zubeldia jersey?
I don't think so. I think Leopold Koenig gets the Zubeldia jersey for riding almost anonymously into the top 10. But third Grand Tour and third top 10 performance. He's been third in the Vuelta, the Tour, and now the Giro. So he's Czech, of course. So, you know, a real mix of nationalities. Yuri Trofimov of Russia, Alexandre Genies of France, and, of course, Stefan Kruijswijk of the Netherlands.
Kruijswijk was impressive. Very aggressive, right? You couldn't accuse him of doing a Zubeldia. You know, to be as aggressive as he was, to be in virtually every move and to still finish, you know, seventh overall is pretty impressive.
Yeah, but on the stage to Sestriere, really, he fluffed his lines, didn't he? He did an awful lot of work for no discernible reason and really blew his chance of winning the stage. And when Aru made that really hard acceleration, Rigoberto Urán was the only person that could go with him for maybe 300-400 metres, and then Aru kicked again. If Kruijswijk had not done all of that work at the bottom of Sestriere, and remember, he'd also had to bridge across on the descent on the flat, he might have had a better chance of winning the stage. But nevertheless, an impressive Giro for him.
Yeah, and Kruijswijk lost 8 minutes, I think 8 minutes 27 in the stage to La Spezia in the first week. Hesjedal also lost a huge amount of time in the first week. I think he lost 5 minutes 25 on stage 4. So without those losses, both of those guys would have been right up there. But it perhaps begs questions about the standard of the race in general. I mean, a lot of people got very excited about Landa's performance, but it remains to be seen just how good that was, because it was a top 10, perhaps lacking some star quality in a race. In general, lacking some star quality, despite a fantastic spectacle. The race in itself was brilliant, and there were an awful lot of top names missing. And also the very nature of the race, it was ridden so hard, so fast, and by general consensus, I think probably the fastest, hardest Giro of the last 15, 20 years, certainly according to most of the guys in the peloton. That sort of brings to the fore a different kind of rider, and that's perhaps also why Hesjedal fared so well in the last week, because he's a real diesel. But we might end up seeing something very different at the Tour de France. It might be a completely different kind of race, or maybe it won't. Maybe we'll see very, very aggressive racing there as well.
It's those things that you, those phenomena that you mentioned, though, Daniel, inevitably also, you know, I saw a lot of comments on Twitter over the weekend, especially when Aru won those two tough mountain stages at the end of the race. You know, the old, you know, too good to be true, or should Astana be as strong as they appear to be? You know, I think they had four riders in the top 10 on the stage on Saturday. And, you know, it's very hard to answer these questions without knowing exactly as you say, Daniel, how strong, how high the quality was in that top 10. And the speed of the race, the overall speed of the race, is often something that's used as evidence that the sport has perhaps not cleaned up. I think, you know, speed, average speed in a Grand Tour is irrelevant, because I think an open race will usually result in a faster race, and a more controlled race is inevitably a bit slower. And neither of those two things actually have any bearing on whether or not the peloton is clean or not. Do you agree with that, Lionel? Do you know what I'm trying to say?
I think the key when it comes to comparing speeds, it's so complex, it's so difficult. You've got to take into account so many different variables, the length of the stages, the way the stages are raced. If you were going to compare, mountain stages with similar altitude gains against one another, you might have a case to say, well, this compares favourably or less favourably with that. But it's the way that the flat stages are raced, because they're the ones where, the average speed can vary more than on the mountain stages. It's almost like a ceiling in terms of the speeds in the mountains. Whereas on the flat stages, if they decide to take it easy for a couple of hours, that's going to knock the average speed down quite significantly. What we've seen in recent Grand Tours is quite a number of the shorter, flatter stages where, they race from the start to the finish. You see that they are basically going flat out from the start to establish the brake, and then there's a chase to bring the brake back in. There's not an awful lot of downtime. I suppose the key here in the Giro, there were a number of very long stages as well, some that were up there with sort of classic length. I mean, Friday's stage, I think, was 230 kilometres, something like that. There was a stage that was as long as Liège-Bastogne-Liège in the first week. But
there were also a lot of very short stages.
Well, exactly. So really, what are we trying to say? The overall average speed of the race doesn't really mean anything in Grand Tour cycling. Otherwise, we'd be taking into account the fact that Contador covered the course in 88 hours, 22 minutes and 25 seconds and analysing whether that means anything.
Is that a record?
It may well be a world record. I don't know. I'd have to check. But we don't take that figure into account and say it doesn't tell us anything. No. It just tells us that he covered the course in that amount of time and that Fabio Aru was 1 minute 53 slower. And I think when you look at patterns, as I've been doing recently, is it a surprise that...
Do you knit?
I don't knit, no.
It'd be something you should think about.
Possibly, yeah. So I've got plenty of time for knitting, Richard, yeah. But when you look at the top 10, is there anyone in there that really is surprising? Is it surprising that Heyerdahl has been Koenig by the gap he has, or that Kruijswijk is up there? And as Daniel makes the point about riders losing time in the first week... it's very difficult to just look at the Grand Tour top 10 and say that tells us anything about the cleanliness or otherwise of the sport.
That's what we're saying, isn't it? I mean, the questions really concerned Astana more than any other team. That, as I said in the podcast last week, I think there's a sort of sense as well of that fitting a narrative that already exists in a lot of people's minds, that Astana are the bad boys, the dirty team, and that anything that they do, people are sort of looking for evidence to back up that theory. And at the Giro, it appeared to be there in the fact that they were a very strong team.
Yeah, and as we mentioned before the Giro, this whole story about Aru's dysentery, a lot's been made of that. There were a lot of snide, snarky comments, particularly on Twitter on the weekend, about dysentery being obviously the perfect preparation for a Grand Tour. I mean, it's just really, we should barely dignify stuff like that with any kind of commentary, because Aru's illness came, it was the 17th of April to the 21st of April. Over 5 days, he lost 4 kilos, not 5 kilos as was reported. But anyway, that was over 2 weeks before the start of the Giro. That has no bearing whatsoever on whether he might be doping or not. There is no plausible connection that can be made, because it was a piece of information that Astana and Aru themselves released. They didn't have to release that information. They could have, if they wanted to make something up, they could have said he had an innocuous knee problem or an ankle problem or a stomach virus, something that would have raised no eyebrows. No, they said that he had dysentery. and you know, most doctors will tell you that you can recover from that, make full recovery within, you know, a week to, or 5 to 10 days, let's say. So, okay, it was probably a setback, but, you know, he'd done 6 months of, he'd started preparing for this Giro in November. Yeah, he perhaps didn't get back to exactly the level he'd had before that illness, but he would have been pretty damn close. And which, none of which is to say that we should have blind faith in Aru and the performances weren't extraordinary, but, you know, joining dots and trying to associate things like an illness 2 weeks before the Giro with, you know, the possibility he might be cheating is just neither here nor there, and it's just nonsense.
It is a fascinating topic, though, and, you know, one that we'll no doubt return to repeatedly, one that will feature in our forthcoming long-awaited PERC, the Podcast Independent Reform Commission, our doping special that's coming up soon for friends of the podcast. In the Our Records episodes, you'll hear a little bit from Alex Dowsett as well, who is the Our Record holder, and he spoke about being up in the Our Record, knowing that he was up, and feeling sort of superhuman. He felt no pain. This is, the Our Record is supposedly the hardest thing that you can do in cycling, and the stories are legion of Eddie Merckx not being able to walk afterwards and so on. But here was a guy on his way to second the Our Record who barely felt the pedals because, A, he knew he was in the form of his life, he felt good, and he was up on the existing record, and he felt invincible. And I think when we see riders winning big races and looking great and piling on the pressure and gaining time on, you know, other world-class riders, that's what happens when guys are leading and winning often. That effect of leading the race, putting time into your rivals, it's the most potent performance-enhancing drug I think there is.
Well, and I think also that you've got to bear in mind, somebody's got to win the stages, somebody's got to win overall, somebody's got to finish on the podium. Where, going back to my recent meme of patterns, it's just...
Again?
Because, I know, it's because they're from the same team, it's because they've ridden in defence of a rider who's going for an overall victory, because they're very prominent. You know, you look at the screen, they stand out in a colour. I'm not saying that that's why people are suspicious of them. It's obvious why people are suspicious of them, because, you know, any kind of sustained, repeated success by more than one rider from the same team, it does raise these questions. But there has to be more to the suspicion than just looking at that particular pattern.
Yeah, as Daniel says, we're not, certainly not discounting the possibility of doping going on among any teams or riders at all, but I don't think, and I've always sort of been very much against automatically assuming that the guys who win are cheating.
No, and one thing I would also say as a bit of a counterpoint is the Giro again underlined the ambivalence towards doping in Italy on several levels. For example, Alessandro Balan being invited as a guest onto Rai's pre-stage or post-stage program, I can't remember which, the fact that he's serving a doping ban not even being referenced. Contador's third Giro d'Italia title being referenced. It's actually his second because he's been stripped of one.
Contador himself made the point that in his mind it's his third, which is not... it's disingenuous, and it doesn't tally with the actual official record.
Yeah. So, I mean, the climate that unfortunately still prevails in Italian cycling is fairly similar to the prevailing climate 5 or 10 years ago, where, you know, doping is kind of written off among euphemisms like problems and, oh, he had his difficulties with this and that, when, and that is slightly alarming. I mean, again, doesn't have much bearing on the likelihood of Aru cheating or not, but it is slightly alarming and slightly disappointing, really.
Well, on that note, shall we wrap up this week's podcast? This week's shorter than usual podcast, because we do have a big week coming up, and we're going to record our preview show for the Our Record very soon and do various other things. Stay tuned to Twitter, etc. So stay tuned for the Our Record special, supported by Jaguar, and the Our Record live broadcast, also supported by Jaguar. In the meantime, we'll be back with a normal episode next week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast. Thank you to Glass Pear for the music in this episode. For more information and to download more editions of the show, visit thecyclingpodcast.com.